most about those who die or those who are merely surveilled and haunted by drones and special forces. This really matters because it's essential that when Biden gave his two speeches the other week defending the pullout from Afghanistan, he made utterly clear that while giving up on failed counterinsurgency, he's turning to, and maybe will intensify himself, the real fruit of 9/11, which is kind of endless counterterror, no matter what the constraints of international law say, unless they require the drones to strike or the special forces to visit with care for the victims.
Samuel Moyen, I want to thank you for being with us. His new book, Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. Professor of Law and History at Yale University.
You tomorrow, are listening Congresswoman to KBOO Portland.
Portland is a
Black people.
Lives disaster.
Program highlighting all the planet's life forms and humanity while choosing all music relating to the topic.
Eclectic. Pandemic.
Politically pandemic. Correct or not, pandemic. No judgment without bias for us all.
Eclectic Pandemic.
503@gmail.com every fourth Monday, 11 p.m. to midnight here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a judge makes a decision after anti-mask rallies in Vancouver and schools go on lockdown. Oregonians are about to have a chance to speak up about how new congressional districts are drawn now that the state is picking up an extra seat in Congress. And how Oregon's facial recognition technology ban could spread to other communities. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 9th, 2021. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. Despite record cases of COVID-19 breaking out, people are still determined to fight mask mandates. A Washington judge has decided to take action. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has more in the story.
A Clark County judge has banned protests and rallies from gathering near Vancouver School District grounds following a recent demonstration that forced three schools into lockdown late last week. The order was signed Tuesday by Superior Court Judge Susan Clark and prohibits any rallies, protests, or demonstrations from forming within a mile of school grounds. Clark's decision follows an anti-mask rally held last Friday that drew dozens of anti-mask supporters, as well as several members of the far-right Proud Boys, to grounds just outside of Skyview High School. According to witnesses, members of the Proud Boys attempted to forcibly enter the main building, intent on escorting an unmasked freshman into the school. This attempted breach of security resulted in district officials immediately calling for a lockdown at Skyview, as well as for lockdowns at the neighboring Alki Middle and Chinook Elementary schools, and prompted the district to request a court order restricting future on-campus demonstrations. Pat Nuzzo, communications director for Vancouver Public Schools, said the lockdown was instituted as a safety precaution, with VPS School Board President Kyle Spruill adding the lockdown was necessary, saying, quote, protesting at our school campuses and disrupting the school day is not in the best interest of students, end quote. Videos surfaced online from the rally where members of the agitated group were seen chanting USA near the school entrance, some wearing black and yellow clothing associated with the Proud Boys. Other witnesses say female students leaving the school were called derogatory names by the crowd, and that district and school employees struggled all day to keep rally participants from entering the building. The far-right militia group Patriot Prayers leader Joey Bishop organized Friday's rally at Skyview online, inciting outrage by making false claims that unmasked students attempting to go to school would be arrested. The unmasked freshman's mother, Megan Gabriel, has helped organize other anti-masking rallies, including a gathering of about 35 people outside of Skyview just the day prior. Gabriel has railed against Washington's mask mandate on social media, calling the requirement, quote, irrational, illegal, unconstitutional, and unscientific, end quote. Gabriel maintains that mask wearing causes panic attacks for her daughter, though she was unable to obtain a medical exemption for the student to override the mandate. Tuesday's court order ban will remain in effect for as long as masks are mandated in the state of Washington. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler said this week that his decision to keep police away from August's violent far-right and far-left rally clashes was a mistake. Activists, residents, and state officials have openly criticized Wheeler, along with Police Chief Chuck LaBelle, for the police bureau's hands-off approach to demonstrations on August 22nd. Proud Boys clash with anti-fascists, resulting in brawls in streets, business parking lots, and school grounds. Bystanders say they felt terrorized and abandoned as fireworks exploded in crowded streets, and people stormed about in helmets and gas masks armed with baseball bats, chemical spray, and paintball guns. Before the August 22nd clash, Mayor Wheeler held a press conference urging people to choose love and not commenting about whether officers were ordered to intervene in the demonstrations. During Portland City Council's Wednesday morning session, Wheeler admitted that was a mistake, saying based on the public outcry, the media outcry, and on the national front, that strategy was the wrong strategy. He said he would ask the police for an analysis on the way the Choose Love plan played out in efforts to better shape police response to political violence moving forward. His comments came in advance of a vote for a $50,000 settlement in a lawsuit from a counter-demonstrator being injured by police during a rally held August 4th by the group Patriot Prayer. The council unanimously passed the settlement. Wheeler says the city and police are still trying to find the right recipe on how to respond to future protests that have the potential to erupt in violence. It's been a year since the city of Portland passed a ban on both public and private use of facial recognition technology. Now some experts are calling Portland's decision a gold standard that the rest of the country should follow. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
A year ago today, Portland passed one of the most sweeping bans of facial recognition technology in the country. The ban includes public and private uses and was pushed because of the technology's discrimination against people of color, women, and other groups, which has been documented across the country. Leah Holland is with the digital rights group Fight for the Future and a Portland resident. She says the resolution has inspired other parts of the country.
Portland's ban on both public and private use of facial recognition technology has served as the gold standard for organizers and activists over the past year as they push for similar legislation in their own cities, states, and on the national scale.
Holland says a resolution in Congress borrows language from Portland's ban. The prohibition went into effect in January. Chris Bushick is head of PDX Privacy. She says it's hard to tell how effective the ban has been because of the pandemic, which has kept many people inside. But she notes that no city bureaus were using the technology as of an assessment in April. Bushick says on the private side, someone has to take legal action in order to prove facial recognition is being used.
So instead, we have to look for violations that did happen, and that would mean lawsuits or other complaints. And so far, we haven't seen any of those in Portland yet.
She says this doesn't necessarily mean there haven't been any use of the technology, just that no lawsuits have been filed. Holland says there still are gaps in the ban. She says it's possible Portland Public Schools, which weren't affected by the ban, were sold a temperature scanning technology that was used to discriminate against a girl in Michigan.
This technology is the exact same technology that misidentified a 14-year-old black girl at a roller rink outside of Detroit and had her kicked out onto the street because they thought she was someone else because the computer said so.
A study from 2020 found the algorithm driving facial recognition technology is least accurate for black women between the ages of 18 and 30. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Portland's plan to protest the new Texas law that bans most abortions hit a snag. KBOO's Althea Billings has the latest.
Portland City Council delayed its vote on banning business with Texas until at least next week. The proposal would ban city departments from buying goods and services based in Texas and would prohibit official travel for city workers. The local ban is in response to Texas's new restrictive abortion law. It prohibits abortions after about 6 weeks, but has been allowed to stand legally since it relies on private citizens to enforce the law, not the government. The law is a huge blow to reproductive justice in the state, since the restriction bans abortions in such a short time frame before many people even know they are pregnant. A Portland City Council spokesperson said that in the past 5 years, about $35 million of goods and services were purchased by the city from businesses in Texas. Those who support the ban point out that it would have economic impact on the state and on Portland itself. If passed, the Portland ban on economic interaction with Texas would last until the legislature or the courts remove the anti-abortion law. The Oregonian editorial board published a piece criticizing the city council's consideration of the Texas ban, calling it, quote, pointless preening, and saying officials should focus more on local problems. The vote hasn't yet been formally rescheduled, but Texas officials have scorned the potential move. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick tweeted saying the ban was, quote, comical, and called Portland a, quote, dumpster fire. The Texas law went into effect this month after the Supreme Court declined to block it. The Justice Department is now suing Texas over the law. An excerpt from their lawsuit reads, quote, "The United States has the authority and responsibility to ensure that Texas cannot evade its obligations under the Constitution and deprive individuals of their constitutional rights by adopting a statutory scheme designed specifically to evade traditional mechanisms of judicial review," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
A Vancouver man convicted in the 2019 killing of a transgender teen received the maximum sentence of 20 years in prison today. A jury found David Bogdanov guilty of murder in the second degree and malicious harassment on August 27th for the death of Nikki Kuhnhausen, a transgender teen who disappeared in June of 2019. 6 months after she went missing, her remains were found on Larch Mountain in a remote part of Clark County. And 6 months after that, police arrested Bogdanov in connection with her death. During the trial, Bogdanov argued that he killed Kuhnhausen in self-defense after a sexual encounter in which he found out she was transgender and claimed that she attacked him. But prosecutors disputed that and showed evidence that the teen's death was not a justifiable homicide. After today's sentencing, surrounded by family and friends, Nikki's mother, Lisa Wood, spoke out outside the courtroom, saying she was just a baby, she was just a teenager, and he took her life. He got the maximum, and that is what he deserves. A federal expansion of unemployment benefits during the COVID pandemic has now expired. This is putting thousands of people across the country at risk of foreclosure. Now they're being urged to seek guidance from emerging assistance programs. As Mike Moen reports, one example is in Minnesota.
State officials say nearly 100,000 Minnesotans are now without extra unemployment benefits provided by the federal government during the crisis. A housing group says that should prompt struggling homeowners to seek help as new assistance efforts take shape. The enhanced federal aid expired this month, but the Minnesota Homeownership Center says there's a new program that aims to protect Hennepin County residents behind on their mortgage payments because of the pandemic. They can connect with advisors and possibly qualify for cash assistance. Group President Julie Guggen says a wave of foreclosures would be devastating as the state continues to navigate the crisis.
We know that foreclosures can be detrimental, not just to homeowners, but to communities writ large. We learned that during the Great Recession.
The center is working with the county in administering the Hennepin Home Ownership Preservation Program. It's being funded by federal relief grants. The Minnesota Housing Finance Agency estimates nearly 70,000 Minnesotans are behind on their monthly payments. The agency is in the process of crafting a similar program that will benefit residents across the state. Housing Commissioner Jennifer Ho says the statewide plan they're developing also is being funded through COVID relief money. She says for good reason, there's been a lot of focus on helping renters during the pandemic, but she says there also needs to be that cushion for homeowners in crisis.
We know if you're a homeowner that's behind, that is hugely stressful. And we know that homeowners who are behind are also disproportionately Black households who are six times more likely to be behind just because of the way way that COVID and everything else has made it tougher on them.
O says they're waiting on approval from federal officials before they launch the statewide program. Guggen says either initiative can help struggling homeowners figure out their next move with federal forbearance protections banks have used to allow households to pause payments no longer in place. She adds the Hennepin County program isn't just designed to fix an immediate crisis.
Consumers who participate in this program must work towards a sustainable solution, which essentially means working with an advisor to figure out how best to balance their budget and to take a close look at the affordability of the home.
Participants who meet income requirements can receive up to $35,000. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
Housing advocates across the country are recommending that tenants who face possible eviction or are negotiating back rent with a landlord should contact a lawyer to help protect their rights. Mark Richardson reports the end of the federal eviction moratorium last month and increasing rents for new housing are making the process more difficult.
Since the end of the federal eviction moratorium in August, renters who are behind on their payments may be forced to juggle competing priorities in dealing with their landlord. Housing advocates say the state still has millions of dollars in emergency rental assistance funds to distribute, but the program has not gone as smoothly as tenants and property owners would like. Complicating the process is that during the pandemic, the cost of renting a home or apartment in Utah has increased sharply. Francesca Blanc with the Utah Housing Coalition says the demand is outpacing the supply.
The prices, the rent are increasing. There's no stop. There's no push on the brakes about it. I don't think it's sustainable at all because a lot of people are paying 50% of their income on rent, and this has an effect on everything else in their life.
Blanc says despite some paperwork hassles early on, the rental assistance programs have improved since the state began sending the rent money directly to the landlords in recent weeks. She says so far the number of actual evictions has remained fairly steady without the expected increase. She says when renters do move out, they encounter something akin to sticker shock when they look for new housing.
Even if they get a 60-day notice that the lease is terminated, they cannot find housing. And the only reason they are terminating the lease is to get renters in that they can pay way more than the previous person.
Eviction filings in Utah were down to about 2,000 in the first 6 months of 2021, a 44% decrease from the same period in 2019. But Blanc says that number is expected to grow unless more money is distributed.
The state of Utah has been providing emergency rental assistance from the legislation that was passed by the Congress last December. Originally, they received about $250 million. I think they are down to about $140 million.
She says there are still several options for people who need assistance or legal help with their rental situation. I'm Mark Richardson for Utah News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio, Real Life in Timber Country. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 10, Radio Lost and Found. Tonight's weather, cloudy with a stray shower or thunderstorm possible, a low near 60. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy skies continue with a high of 71. Today in history, on this date in 1776, the Continental Congress formally renamed our country the United States of America. The quote of the day is from Richard Henry Lee, who wrote the resolution, quote, "These United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states." A short period for public input on Oregon's voting maps begins. The Oregon legislature's released two different maps for how to draw its six congressional districts now that the state's population growth has earned it an extra spot in Congress. As Eric Tegedov reports, the state has some critical decisions to make after gaining a congressional seat from the 2020 census.
A small window for public input is open to discuss the Oregon legislature's proposed voting maps. After receiving detailed census data in August, lawmakers released their recommended redistricting maps on September 3rd. They began holding virtual public meetings in the state's five current congressional districts on Wednesday, with two scheduled for each district through Monday. There also will be a statewide meeting on Monday. Precious Edmonds with the organization We Draw Oregon is encouraging people to get involved in the process.
It really does matter what district you lie in, particularly for communities that have been marginalized in the past, making sure that they have the opportunity to have their interests reflected in the government.
Edmonds says people of color have seen their power diluted in the redistricting process in the past. Her group has been working to make public meetings as accessible as possible. The legislature also is taking public input online through Monday. On the congressional level, Oregon has received an extra seat, making the redistricting process especially important for power on the national level. Plans also have been released for the lines of the state's 30 Senate seats and 60 House seats. Edmonds says drawing a line through communities can dilute their power.
We advocate for, whenever possible, keeping communities as whole as possible to preserve that right.
Edmonds notes that keeping communities whole also makes it more likely that their representative will look like them. She says her organization already has identified some districts that could dilute power for Black, Indigenous, and Latinx communities. The legislature aims to have new district maps completed by September 27th. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A new plan from President Biden could mandate COVID shots or tests for about two-thirds of American workers. He's requiring all federal employees to get vaccinated against COVID-19, and the Department of Labor will require businesses with more than 100 workers to have those employees vaccinated or tested weekly. These are among the president's six new steps to combat the coronavirus. This comes as the U.S. heads toward an October debt default, and Vice President Kamala Harris says there's a lot at stake in the California recall election. For more, here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
We're all working together to get the virus under control, to return to our normal lives.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says President Joe Biden will announce six new steps in the COVID response.
Some of that will be related to access to testing. Some will be related to mandates. Some will be related to how we ensure kids are protected in schools.
New cases are approaching 150,000 per day, and ICUs are at more than 90% capacity in seven states. Republican Congressman Greg Murphy, who is also a doctor, visited a hospital in his North Carolina district where he says 90% of COVID patients on breathing tubes are unvaccinated.
The sicker people oftentimes have those comorbidities, the obesity, the diabetes mellitus, the kidney disease. However, it can occur in 25-year-olds who are stone cold healthy.
Meanwhile, Republicans Marjorie Taylor Greene and Chip Roy have been fined for not wearing masks on the House floor. Some conservative members of Congress resist mandatory COVID-19 prevention measures. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warns the U.S. will run out of cash in October unless Congress raises the debt limit. Senate Republicans, including John Thune of South Dakota, aren't interested.
I don't think there's a single Republican senator who views increasing the debt limit so the Democrats can expand government and spend massive amounts of money as something that they, in the end, would want to support.
Democrats plan to pursue a bipartisan vote to waive the debt limit. A progressive group launched a $1.5 million campaign to build support to expand the U.S. Supreme Court from 9 seats to 13. Calls for a more balanced court have grown, especially after Senate Republicans rushed to fill Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat just weeks before the 2020 election. Democrats were outraged then, and also after Senate Republicans denied a Supreme Court seat to President Barack Obama's nominee in 2016, current Attorney General Merrick Garland. Election workers who face intimidation have a new outlet for assistance. The Election Official Legal Defense Network will provide free legal aid to officials from any jurisdiction. In Harris County, Texas, Chief Deputy Clerk Michael Wynn says he witnessed several attempts to cause conflict at the polls in November.
In the quest for transparency, there were those who saw an opportunity to create falsehoods that tried to undermine the elections process in Harris County.
Nearly one in three local election officials surveyed said they feel unsafe in their jobs. Vice President Kamala Harris stumped in California for Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom, who is facing a recall election next week. Harris says there's more at stake than just the future of the Golden State.
What's happening around our country with these policies that are about attacking women's rights, reproductive rights, voting rights, workers' rights? They think if they can win in California, they can do this anywhere.
Opponents attack Newsom's response to the pandemic, extreme weather, and the state's homelessness and housing crisis. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Minnesota loses its bid to stop a lawsuit in tribal court over a pipeline. And one of the only nine remaining Klan houses in Sitka, Alaska, is on the verge of collapse. For more, here's today's edition of National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
A federal judge dismissed the state of Minnesota's efforts to stop a tribal lawsuit over Enbridge Line 3 pipeline water permits. The judge said the tribe's sovereign immunity bars the court from granting injunction relief. The White Earth Band of Ojibwe and a treaty rights attorney filed a lawsuit against Enbridge's Line 3 project in tribal court. The lawsuit made national headlines because the lead plaintiff is Manuman, or wild rice. The lawsuit alleged the state failed to protect water resources and endangered the crop and violated tribal members' treaty rights to harvest it. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources was seeking an injunction in U.S. federal court. The state said White Earth did not have jurisdiction over DNR or its employees. Minnesota's attorney general responded to the dismissal, saying precedent is established that federal courts have jurisdiction to review tribal court jurisdiction. One of only nine remaining clan houses in Sitka, Alaska, is on the verge of collapse. The historic property is deeply rooted in Sitka's clan traditions, and its passing is a significant milestone. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The century-old frame house is one of a pair side-by-side on Catlan Street in a historic district of Sitka that was resettled by Tlingit following conflict with the Russians in the 19th century. The house itself was built later in the early 20th century and was steeped in tradition even then. Robbie Littlefield is chair of the Sitka Historic Preservation Commission and a Tlingit language scholar.
So this house was called Dukinahit. And some people translate that as the far out house, but it comes from a very ancient raven story about how Raven pulled the salmon house to shore from the open ocean. And that's how the salmon began to swim upstream.
Dukinahit is slumping into the embankment behind it and looks like it could further collapse and slide into the roadway. Sitka police plan to keep the street closed indefinitely until the city works out a stabilization plan with the owners, and that will be difficult on several levels. The house may not be saved, and Littlefield says that should be acknowledged.
This house had a spirit, and it's passing away. It's leaving our world now.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
On Wednesday, U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland swore in Brian Newland as the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs. Newland previously served as president of the Bay Mills Indian Community, as well as chief judge of the Bay Mills Tribal Court. From 2009 to 2012, Newland served as a policy advisor to the then Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. Haaland will postpone a trip to Alaska this month out of concern for the state's rising rates of COVID-19. The Interior Secretary was expected to visit in mid-September. The department announced the trip will be made later this year. The announcement said the decision was made in consultation with Alaska Native and local leaders. A federal judge denied a bid to stop construction near the proposed Thacker Pass lithium mine site. Tribal leaders were seeking a temporary injunction to stop construction of the mine about 25 miles south of the Nevada-Oregon border. The tribes wanted to perform an archaeological study on the land that they say is sacred and where their ancestors were massacred more than a century ago. The judge denied a similar request in July when environmentalists were seeking an injunction because they claimed digging would destroy critical habitat for greater sage grouse. A key component in electric vehicle batteries, demand for lithium is expected to triple over the next 5 years. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe will receive $1 million for its Children's Mental Health Initiative. The tribe's initiative aims to improve the mental health outcomes of young people up to the age 21 and their families experiencing serious emotional disturbance. The funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and its Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. For National Native News, I'm Tripp Krause.
As the anniversary of 9/11 approaches, a Catholic LGBTQ group is organizing an effort for a priest who died on 9/11 to become a saint. Emily Scott has more in the story.
With the 20th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, a Catholic LGBTQ organization is launching a campaign advocating for the sainthood of Father Michael Judge, the New York City Fire Department chaplain who died inside the World Trade Center while praying for the victims. Francis DiBernardo of New Ways Ministry, which is behind the campaign, first heard about Judge in the aftermath of 9/11 when his story spread throughout the country. DiBernardo says through Judge's work supporting HIV/AIDS ministries, Alcoholics Anonymous, and as a member of the LGBTQ community, he provided support to many.
He would really be a saint, not only for firefighters, not only for recovering alcoholics, not only for the LGBTQ community, but he'd be a saint for 9/11, a saint for representing all of those people who suffered and died.
In 2017, Pope Francis announced new pathways to sainthood for people who have sacrificed their lives for others. Since then, DiBernardo has been in contact with Luis Escalante of the Vatican's Congregation for Causes of Saints to research Judge's sainthood qualifications. Now a pastor in Michigan, Salvador Sapienza got to know Judge in the late 1980s, during the height of the AIDS crisis in New York. Sapienza became involved with Judge's AIDS ministry organization in Manhattan, where they would visit people living with AIDS in hospitals and hold weekly prayers for them and their families. Sapienza says even in life, Judge was a saintly figure.
Michael just had a wonderful way of seeing all people as one, because he just exuded such love, and he really made them feel God's love. And that really was his message. His message was, I want you to know how much God loves you.
New Ways Ministry plans to contact firefighter organizations, Catholic LGBTQ groups, and others to help form an association dedicated to sponsoring Judge's sainthood cause. I'm Emily Scott with New York News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 9th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Althea Billings, Mark Richardson, Eric Tegedoff, Mike Moen, and Emily Scott. The producer is Lynette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us.
Hey everybody, thank you for tuning in to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. And today we're talking with award-winning author, essayist, and commentator, Robert Leo Heilman from Myrtle Creek, Oregon. Bob is the author of several books, including Overstory Zero, Real Life in Timber Country, Children of Death, and The World Pool, a literary variety. He has also been a prolific contributor to guest columns in his local paper. Hey, welcome Bob. Thanks for joining us on Coast Range Radio.
Well, thank you for putting me on.
Yeah, you know, I recently came across your work when I got an email from the Rural Organizing Project, and they republished a piece you did in the Daily Yonder, Broken Glass, Broken Trust, where you describe threats and violence, including two instances where your windows have been recently broken out by a bullet and a brick in response to some of your writings. And in that piece, you write, "Over the past 31 years, I have remained the only Umpquan to publicly say that neighbors shouldn't threaten violence against each other over their political differences." And in your writing, you're publicly, you know, challenging some the extremism and fear you're seeing in your community. And, you know, I was moved by the ending of your piece and wanted to reach out and have this conversation with you. You write, "What is most troubling to me about these extremists is not the broken glass, but both here in my home in Washington, D.C., but the broken trust in each other in our democracy and that such fear inevitably brings." I wanted to reach out and maybe share your experiences with our listeners, kind of hear from you what you've been dealing with. And just maybe we could start with, you know, you've been living in Myrtle Creek for over 30 years. Maybe give us a little grounding on, you know, what's changed over that time, and, you know, what's been your experience like living and writing in Douglas County and being such a public voice and challenging some of this extremism and fear that you're seeing in your community?
I've lived in Myrtle Creek for 46 years now.
Oh, wow.
Since 1975. We came here in May of 75, so 46 years. Raised my son here, bought some property in 1978 and paid it off over a 30-year loan. So we've been around here for quite a while.
Yeah.
I've worked here, I've volunteered here quite a bit. It is the place where I learned to be a writer. It's a wonderful place. I love it. But yes, it has been difficult at times watching the changes come along. The early 1980s recession hit here very, very strongly. We lost an awful lot of families, young families with children, when people had to pack up and leave and go look for work. We were up to, at one point, all the way up to 20% unemployment in our county. So that came along, then the houses stood empty for a while, for a few years, and then slowly they began to fill up again, but this time with retirees. So that leaves you with a very different population. And in many ways, the place has become a lot less rural. I often see it as a changeover from neighborliness. We used to rely very heavily on each other as neighbors, neighborliness. It's a neighbor is a word that comes from the German Nachbar, the near farmer. And so we this change over from that to a more civilized, again, from the Latin civis, meaning a city, is really a good deal of what we're starting to see here. And it's kind of a shame to see the old ways go away.
Yeah, and you mentioned when we talked earlier, you know, that neighbors and folks reach out to you and say they're very thankful that you have, you know, written what you have written, that you're calling out some of these issues, and you're publicly trying to educate folks. And they say that they're afraid to speak out themselves. What has, why have you kind of taken on this role as someone who is kind of putting yourself out there?
Well, I'm a writer. And as such, I don't really feel like I have much of a choice in the matter. There really is such a thing as duty. And part of my duty is to, you know, I have this skill. I'm able to write stuff that people read. Not all people who write can do that.
Yeah.
By the way. And so it's an important way for me to fill my role as a citizen, as a member of this community, to speak out on various things that are going on. Again, like the forest debates, the problems that we were having with the libraries, which we're still having, and again, lately, because of the increase in openness of right-wing extremism around here, much of the right-wing extremism has actually gone mainstream in a way, in that local politicians have bought into it very heavily. One of our county commissioners is a former Tea Party figure. Our state senator was recently involved with a group called Citizens Against Tyranny, and which was an anti COVID mandates kind of a thing. Yeah. So these are all, you know, problems that we have here in this community. And if you only get a one-sided view of them, if you don't stop and bring an educated view, a view that involves an awareness of history and of the origins of some of these notions, such as sovereign citizenship, I've written about that, posse comitatus, some of these things that become you know, heavily involved with within our local politics.
From your experience, what are maybe some suggestions you have for folks who would like to, you know, fulfill some sort of, maybe they have, you know, an ability to write, or they have an ability to work within their communities. What are some lessons from your experience in doing that? How do you, you know, get the courage to speak out, even though there is these, you're getting these threats, and there's danger involved in what you're doing.
Well, I don't really think of it as being courageous, to tell you the truth. I've always been a loudmouth, and so that's just part of my nature. I'm a writer. I put things out there for the world. I'm used to that. I'm an artist, and as such, I've spent many, many decades dealing with fear, with my own fear, fears around creativity. You can't be creative if you're fearful. So I don't know. I don't see it as particularly courageous or anything. But by and large, our fears are never, almost never, let's put it that way, justified to begin with. And they are things that inhibit us, that keep us from being able to realize our dreams. So I think really right now, the most radical thing you can tell people is don't be afraid, because we have so much fear being thrown at us constantly from so many different sources. Some of it's political stuff, you know, the words of demagogues and such. Some of it is just commercially motivated, you know, because scaring people about certain things is profitable, you know, on the corporate level. And from insecurities that we have about, this, that, and the other thing, the unwillingness to express ourselves publicly, in that perhaps people won't like us, you know. What happens then? You know, what will the neighbors think? So these are genuine considerations that people have. And I don't really know how anybody else overcomes them. But for me, it's just a habit. It's habitual. I couldn't do the work I do if I was afraid.
And that's really interesting, because it also, you in your writing, you talk about the fear that is kind of, you know, being exploited in the rhetoric and the propaganda around some of this right-wing extremism and the violence that then comes from that. There is a connection to there as far as the hatred coming from fear. That's something you've kind of learned from your experience working in your community and communicating with people and research.
Well, as a writer, human nature is my stock in trade.
Yeah.
This is what I work with, right? I'm an essayist, so I ponder things, and much of what I ponder is the question of what makes us human, and how do our emotions affect our thinking, you know, these kinds of questions. So that's, again, it comes with the turf. And I truly do believe, this may be a bit irrelevant, I suppose, but that everyone of us are artists, that we are all have something that we can do that will contribute to our society, our community, by creating things which are beautiful. In my case, I try to write beautifully and usefully, because the two are closely connected, utility and sheer beauty. I heard a Dominican theologian one time, he had a little rap about creativity and related it to the book of Genesis, the notion that God created humankind in his own image. And his rap was, well, what does that mean exactly, the image of God? And his answer was that we are creative. We are probably the most creative species on the planet. And when you're doing that, you're doing what you as a human being are meant to be doing.
And then I'm thinking about creativity as far as building community, in building trust, in the creation of that. What are some of the techniques you use in your community to build that trust? It's something that, you know, you call out in your piece. From your experience, what are some things you do in your place there in Myrtle Creek to build that community trust and be creative in community building?
You can't help your community without being out in it. You see, there's this crazy search for metaphorical common ground, it's silly to go looking for metaphorical common ground. The only way to do any good is by walking on real ground, walking around the place where you live. So getting involved in community activities is the way you establish personal relationships. And, go out and volunteer at the food bank and help hand out food boxes, coach a little league team, teach children how to play chess, river cleanup day, all of these sorts of community actions, communal things that go on. Every little town around here has summer parties, summer festival things that they do. And, just even participating in those, just going to, Pioneer Days or the Sawdust Jubilee or the Summer Festival or the Blackberry Festival, these sorts of things, puts you out there in the crowd, talking to people, meeting people, getting to where you recognize each other. And that's very important. You can't really do a whole hell of a lot of good in the world unless that's where you're at. Sitting around and theorizing it and about things and making plans and all that kind of stuff, big plans. The bigger the plan, generally speaking, the more worthless it is. So I'm a big believer in interpersonal relationships, I guess would be a fancy way of saying that. But getting to know your neighbors, sharing work with them, because I'm a big believer in work. This is how we get things done.
And then, you can bring up maybe a more difficult conversation when there you have a baseline.
Well, exactly. Respect is earned. It's not given automatically. In order to be respectable, you have to be respectful, right? So this is what you have to do. You have to respect your neighbors, regardless of what their outlook or opinions happen to be. And it's necessary because you share the same place, and the place itself, meaning the place as a physical geographical thing, and also as a community of a group of people who all are in proximity to each other and interact with each other all the time. You have to get out there and mingle and be part of it. You can't isolate yourself from it and expect to do much in the way of good in the world.
It makes me think, we have the interpersonal, the local community, the, local politics, but then how does that play out in, your experience? You've worked in the timber industry. I'm just thinking as an example, we have these large scale kind of forces that also have huge impacts on how, the living conditions of people, the environment, the condition of our, waterways and forests, how do we work on those types of issues, or how do we handle, these institutional, maybe like big Wall Street investment based timber companies who own vast amounts of land that are absentee landowners, federal lands, public lands. It's a kind of a big question, but how does it scale from there, you know, from what we're talking about in community in place?
Well, you know, they say all politics is local. I think that's very true. People can organize protests. You can write letters to your congressman and, you know, do all those kinds of usual things that people do. It's tremendously difficult. We really need to figure out some way of giving corporations a conscience. By and large, and the larger the organization, more likely it is to be sociopathic. Truly sociopathic, very narrow-minded, focused on a very small moral considerations. You know, if the extent of your reasoning is profit is good and what gets in the way of it is bad, and that's it, that's all you're taking into consideration, then that's a problem. Henry David Thoreau pointed it out back in 1848 in Civil Disobedience, when he wrote, "It is truly enough said that a corporation has no conscience, but a corporation of conscientious men is a corporation with a conscience." So how do we do that? Very famous comparison, for example, is Costco versus Walmart, right? Two completely different approaches to how you deal with your employees and the public. You know, Costco treats their people really well. They have a very small turnover. Production kind of stuff goes really well for them because there's loyalty there. Walmart, they don't care if you live or die. They simply don't, you know. To them, it's bottom line stuff, totally bottom line. You know, that which increases profits is we are going to do. That which gets in the way of it, we will not do. So it's a question of you know, can we do it? If we can't do that, if we don't figure out how to do that, we will not survive the 21st century.
In your experience in, you know, living in Myrtle Creek and the heart, you know, of Douglas County, the timber capital of the nation, what's the on the ground discussion as far as, you know, big companies, the warehousers, the Roseburg Forest Products? Is there loyalty there? Is there, yeah?
Well, when it comes to Rosie, as it's known locally, it used to be Roseburg Lumber Company. And they keep changing their name now. There was a big strike in 1989. During the recessions of the 1980s, the company went to their workers, they are unionized workers, went to them and asked for wage cuts and made a promise that they would restore the level of wages after the recession came about. They did not fulfill that promise. The union went out on strike. It was a very bitter strike. Went on for 5 months. And in the end, they ended up signing a contract that was worse than the one they went out on strike over. Because everybody, they just could not sustain the strike. I remember talking to one of their management people who keeps track of you know, the money end of things one time. And he said that because they lost the loyalty of the workers, they ended up losing whatever gain they had made by cutting the wages in decreased productivity. So that's interesting. You know, loyalty actually pays. If you have workers who are willing to work a couple more minutes into their break just to make sure that they get this last little pallet load secured, you know, these kinds of things, it pays. it's good for business. But that's a difficult one to get across if, you know, you're coming at it from a master of business administration kind of background and never have actually spent any time working in the mill.
Yeah.
So this is part of the, you know, the operating on theory rather than experience. Rosie used to belong to Kenneth Ford. People loved him. They called him Pappy Ford, in fact, you know. And he worked his way up. He started out with a dump truck and ended up with a multi-million dollar business that he owned outright, completely. You know, at one point, I remember it was valued at $500 million, $500 million. He died, his son took over. His son had been to Yale University, and he brought in management people who come out of colleges where they're taught a very different style than what the old man had, you know. Very impersonal instead, very much based on spreadsheets and the results of numbers.
Quarterly profits, so, yeah.
Yeah, right, profit and loss, that's all we're gonna think about. So there it is, you know, it's not good for the company really, and it's very rough on the community, extremely rough on the community really. And Rosie left. They picked up their corporate headquarters and moved to Springfield. It's now Roseburg Forest Products Company of Springfield, Oregon, after 80 years worth of being a local business. They are no longer a local business. They've still got their mills down here, but the corporate level is being taken care of out of Springfield. The reason they said that they moved to Springfield was that they couldn't find people who wanted to live here in our county, which I find insulting, but there it is, you know. And
they couldn't find the elite managers, the spreadsheet people,
who wanted to live in a rural place. Yeah. Exactly. They say they want the amenities that Eugene and Springfield offer. They don't want to live in Myrtle Creek. So there is a sense of contempt there, isn't there, you know, on their part. Do they actually care about us here? No, they don't. They really don't.
And then you can see that in the wages, the living conditions, the work conditions that people experience.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Yeah, the average chamber worker now earns 20% less than what they were earning in the late 1970s, early 80s. Those have all been pay cuts. People talk a lot, of course, about automation coming in and the loss of jobs there, and that is definitely a factor, a major factor. But also a chunk of it is this wage cuts. You pay people less, and then they have less money to spread around the community. All through the so-called timber wars, the timber industry was putting out propaganda saying, you know, every dollar that we pay out in wages circulates around the community four or five times. Well, when you cut pay by 20%, now you're contributing to the community as a whole 20% less than what you were.
Yeah. Well, I want to give you a chance here at the end of the program to maybe give your pitch for Overstory Zero, Real Life in Timber Country. Yeah, just want to make sure folks have heard of that book and go out and get it. I just purchased it. I haven't had a chance to read through it yet, but I'm very excited to.
Sure. It's Overstory Zero is a collection of essay, memoir, and lyrical nonfiction writing. Mostly freelance kind of pieces that I did over a period of years. And all of it is set in Douglas County, Oregon, here where I live, and much of it is personal experience essay, and so it's a sharing of, you know, what I've been through, what my friends and my neighbors have been through here, living, trying to get by, trying to survive here in Southern Oregon, in a small town. It's many people did not survive. And that's also something that I mentioned in there quite a bit, talking about the people who didn't make it. So it's a good book. It did well. I've sold 7,000 copies of it, I think, so far over the years. It's made me a lot of friends that I never had before.
Nice. Well, thank you so much, Bob, for taking the time to chat with us on Coast Range Radio.
Sure thing, Andrew.
Well, that's it, everyone. Thanks for tuning into Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. We'll be back with you in another 2 weeks, and we'll talk to you next time.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Hey, KBOO members. It's time once again to vote and make your voices heard. KBOO's 2021 annual membership meeting and board election is coming up on Sunday, September 26th from 1 to 3 p.m., live streaming from the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. KBOO members are invited to participate in a lively discussion on how to reconnect KBOO's diverse communities after 18 months of the pandemic, the role of radio in the 21st century, and the upcoming celebration of our 54th anniversary. KBOO depends on its members to help shape its operations and programming. So show your support by casting your vote and joining this community forum. Be sure to check your mailbox for your ballot and voting information. If you don't receive your ballot in the mail by September,